Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Mathematics, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Corey Brunson, a host of the channel, and today I'm talking with David Lindsay Roberts, author of Republic of Numbers, Unexpected Stories of Mathematical Americans Through History. This is a history of the maturation of mathematics as a discipline, as an institution, as a culture in the United States. Somewhat unconventionally written, it's organized around 20 short biographies, which are anchored to this series of decadal seminal events in that development. We'll get into the themes and specific developments a little more during the interview, but for now, I'd like to welcome Dave to the podcast.
Thank you, Corey. Pleasure to be here.
So, Dave, I wonder if you could begin by describing your own background in mathematics and or in the history of mathematics and how that eventually led to the project that culminated in this book.
Yes. Well, I have what I would consider a fairly broad background in mathematics. Some might say parts of it are shallow, but I have my fingers in a number of different parts of mathematics I have had over the years. So I have some experience with what it means to be a research mathematician, for example. On the other hand, I've taught mathematics at many levels, from pre-algebra all the way up to third semester calculus. I've also worked as an applied mathematician. And finally, I have professional training as a historian of mathematics. So I cover a lot of bases with regard to my background in mathematics. And moreover, I guess I would say that I have a deep personal connection with mathematics from family connections. My father was a PhD mathematician. My grandfather, my mother's father, was a PhD physicist with a major interest in mathematics. My grandmother, my mother's mother, had a master's degree in mathematics. So I do have this, mathematics has been part of my life for a long time and in many different guises, I would say. Now, as far as I started off, in fact, my education, I got a bachelor's degree in mathematics at Kenyon College, liberal arts college in Ohio, and then I went on to graduate work in mathematics at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. I had the intention of getting a PhD in mathematics. The idea was that I would become a research mathematician. That was my goal at that time. And that did not work out. I instead got a consolation master's degree in mathematics and then a second master's degree in industrial engineering, more properly. I mean, that's what it says on my diploma, but it really was what mathematicians refer to as operations research, or a variety of applied mathematics. And I used that master's degree to get employment in the defense consulting industry. near Washington, D.C., which is where I grew up. So I was really returning home for that. And I worked in that field for 11 years. And after I got tired of that, that was an interesting job for a while, but I did eventually get tired of it and thought I would like to go back into academia. But I didn't really want to go back into mathematics per se. I finally decided to go back in history of science. I went and got a PhD in the history of science at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore with a dissertation focused on history of mathematics education. And I became essentially a specialist in that subfield within the history of science. And I wrote some books and some articles on the subject. There was a book in 2008 that I collaborated on with Peggy Kidwell and Amy Ackerberg Hastings called Tools of American Mathematics Teaching. It's what historians refer to as material culture book, because it talks about physical things used in the math classroom over the past 200 years of American history. Blackboards and protractors and slide rules and so on. That was one book that I contributed to. Then I wrote a book on my own, which was basically a revision of my dissertation at Johns Hopkins called American Mathematicians as Educators. And that book appeared in 2012. And at some point, I came to the attention of one of the editors at the Johns Hopkins University Press, Vince Burke. I had reviewed a manuscript for him, and I guess he was impressed with what I had done with that. And he had an idea for a book about history of mathematics that he thought was unique, which would be a decade-by-decade survey of American history, with each decade focused on some mathematical event. And he wondered if I might be interested in writing such a book, and I pondered it for a while. And I eventually decided I would take a crack at it, but I changed it fairly substantially, I would say, because I put more of a biographical emphasis on it than I think he originally intended. And I didn't the chapters were no longer tightly focused on a decade. I would begin a chapter with some episode that occurred in a decade, but then I would go backward in time and forward in time in order to cover the biography of the person who was involved with this initial episode. And so that became this new book, Republic of Numbers.
And so you deviated a little bit from your editor's suggested project. And in particular, I'm interested in how you selected, rather than events, the characters, the mathematicians or people whose activities contributed to the history or to the development of mathematics, and in particular, since they're so interconnected through institutional affiliations, through advisorship, through other social connections, whether that sampling was done more in a sort of citation tracing way or more as a selection based on trying to build up a representative sample of the kinds of people who contributed to mathematics over the course of our history.
Yeah, that was really quite interesting, the process of choosing. Some of it, I sort of took the path of least resistance and used people that I had already had some special knowledge of. Some of this knowledge came from deep in my own personal experience. For example, Willard Gibbs and E.B. Wilson were connected to me in a very personal way, because Gibbs was the teacher of E.B. Wilson, and E.B. Wilson in turn was the teacher of my grandfather, R. Bruce Lindsay. And so that led me to propose both Willard Gibbs and E.B. Wilson as possible chapter subjects, and then I felt that I was able to treat them in such a way that they made sense in the book. There was another set of individuals who became subjects of chapters, who were connected with an oral history project that I did in the early 2000s for the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics, with support from the Educational Advancement Foundation of Austin, Texas. And I did these interviews mainly with math educators of various stripes, and three of them, Frank Allen and Isaac Virchup and Edgar Edwards, became subjects of chapters. Now, some of the people, there were a couple that I had hardly had any knowledge of before I wrote my chapters. I would say Catherine Beecher, for example, was someone I had only vaguely heard of. I knew of Harriet Beecher Stowe, her sister, but I didn't really know much about Catherine Beecher at all. So it was an interesting process where I would come up with a person. It seemed to me that sometimes I would come up with a person and then find an incident that seemed interesting, dramatic enough to use as the opening of the chapter. There were a couple times where I had an incident and then just had to decide whether the person connected with it was of sufficient importance or interest to me. So it was a very fascinating process coming up with these people.
And in addition to the episodes or the events that open the chapters, you conclude each chapter with, as I read them, a coda that gives the reader an impression of the legacy of the individual or individuals subjects of those chapters. And I wonder if you framed these chapters consciously with a theme or even a takeaway moral in mind, or if these were just your attempts to give an impartial account of the person's life as it influenced the trajectory of mathematics.
Yeah, I think it's more the last of those choices that you gave me. I don't think I was very consciously trying to come up with morals. But I did want to have some sort of satisfying, at least to my mind, some sort of satisfying ending to a chapter. I didn't want to let things sort of drivel off without kind of making a point of some sort. I'm happier with some of the end chapter endings than I am with others, just as I'm happier with some of the openings than with others. But I did try to have them end with a, as you say, a coda.
With that, I thought we would talk through a handful of your mini biographies, your chapters, to get a sense for the kinds of stories you're telling and the kinds of people at the centers of them. Beginning with chapter 2, Sylvanus Thayer, who was an early West Point graduate and left quite a substantial impact on West Point Military Academy.
That's right. Thayer's is someone that I didn't have any particular personal knowledge of or deep connections with. As soon as I became a professional historian of mathematics, and especially interested in mathematics education, I learned of the importance of West Point in the history of American mathematics education. It's both higher education and they had some influence on secondary schools too, as I'll mention shortly. But when the country was founded, there were a number of colleges that were in existence, famous colleges that people have all heard of and that still exist today, Harvard and Yale and Dartmouth and William and Mary. these colleges in the late 1700s were basically for training clergymen. They might train a few lawyers and doctors too, but they were not specifically not training anybody that might be. They had no intention of training people to become what we would consider a scientist or mathematician. They might have created a few by accident, but not on purpose. And they basically were not concerned with what we would call generally technical education, mathematics and related fields. And so West Point came along in the early 1800s with a very different aim, which was very much more technical than anything that had been previously going in the way of a higher education. And they made a point there from early on of emphasizing mathematics in order to train especially military engineers, those who were involved with fortifications and figuring out how to aim artillery and such things. There was felt to be a clear need for such people to know something about technical matters, so that it was not proper to train them the way people were being trained at Harvard. Now, the early years of the military academy at West Point were kind of chaotic, and what Thayer did is to regularize things, to put in place some rules and regulations that seem to us so obvious that they ought to be done that it's hard to understand why they weren't done beforehand. Just the fact that he said now everybody that wants to come to the academy needs to show up in the fall at the same time to begin classes. Previously, people just sort of wandered in anytime they felt like it. And he provided, housing for the students and faculty and class schedules and so on. A very strict program to determine, when somebody was fully trained and could be appropriately graduated. And he had learned about what technical education could be at a very high level when he went over to France shortly before he became superintendent at the military academy, and learned what was going on at the famous school over there in Paris, the École Polytechnique, which was the famous school that was staffed by some very high level mathematicians. And was also had an engineering aim, although some of the mathematicians were teaching things and doing research at a level well beyond anything needed by any of the engineers. But Thayer took great inspiration from the École Polytechnique, and he came back to the States and brought some of the lessons over to the academy when he became superintendent at a very young age, I might add. And then he stayed for a very long time, much longer than anybody subsequently would stay as superintendent. He was there for 16 years. And nobody else stayed longer than 8.
16 years included quite a few elements of his legacy, including the training of teachers who would go on, in addition to teaching courses at West Point, all over the rest of the United States.
That's right, yes. He trained a number of teachers who then stayed on as teachers at West Point, and they in turn trained other teachers who became teachers at other institutions. Quite a large number of teachers of graduates of West Point became mathematics teachers at either other colleges or at secondary schools. And some famous generals, for example, Stonewall Jackson was a math teacher taught at Virginia Military Institute. And Robert E. Lee taught mathematics at West Point. Ulysses S. Grant had fully intended to be a math teacher, but he got kind of sidetracked. So, and then there's other, you know, much less famous folks that, that became teachers and had longer careers as teachers than some of these generals who were the famous generals. But and there were a number of West Point graduates who became textbook writers too, and by that means they spread the mathematical literacy around the country.
That makes for an interesting segue, because around the time Thayer was helping to inaugurate the institutionalization of mathematics training, Catherine Beecher and Joseph Ray, in their different ways, were helping to inaugurate the textbook industry. Can you talk a little bit about their contributions and their contrast with each other?
Yes, they are an interesting pair that I just mentioned that I didn't know much about Catherine Beecher until I started to write this book. The other pair, the other member of the pair, Joseph Ray, was somebody that I'd learned about fairly early on during my dissertation research, because he was a teacher of mathematics at a rather famous high school in Cincinnati, called the Woodward High School, which was a school that produced a number of fairly prominent people, including a subject of another chapter, E.H. Moore, a famous mathematician at the University of Chicago. Also, Woodward graduated William Howard Taft, the President of the United States. So I was aware of Ray as an important figure in mathematics education. And as I read about Cincinnati, I learned that Catherine Beecher was in Cincinnati at the same time that Joseph Ray was. And moreover, she had written an arithmetic textbook, just as Joseph Ray did. So I found that an interesting pairing that I could use for that chapter. Beecher had wide-ranging intellectual interests. She was one of a large family. Her father was a famous evangelical minister, and of course her sister was the famous Harriet Beecher Stowe, Uncle Tom's Cabin fame. But Catherine Beecher had many claims to fame of her own right. She was very interested describing how women, especially unmarried women, could have careers on their own and could be properly educated to this state. And she used her interest in education to found or promote several schools around the country in Hartford and in Cincinnati and in Milwaukee. And so she was a very interesting figure. Her arithmetic textbook was not terribly successful. She tended to blame that on the fact that she thought the publisher did not promote it sufficiently because she was a woman, and there's probably some truth to that. Ray, on the other hand, was very successful as a textbook writer and his books became the foundation of a great publishing juggernaut that's literally sold millions of copies. He's sometimes called the McGuffey of mathematics because, as many people will recall, there's a famous series of reading textbooks written by William McGuffey, who was also at this Woodward High School in Cincinnati. And Ray and McGuffey were sort of simultaneously writing these textbooks, McGuffey in English and reading and Ray in mathematics, and both of them were enormously successful, became, you know, basically a publishing empire. And they were publishing initially with a Cincinnati publisher who was very aggressive in creating textbook series, which proved to be a very wise business decision that Catherine Beecher did not partake of. So the Cincinnati publishers were eventually bought out by publishers in New York City, but the Cincinnati publishers were the kernel of that publishing empire.
How about that? I did not know the simultaneity of these two serialization efforts. And so while Ray was pioneering serial textbook writing, Beecher was, to some extent, pioneering the expansion of access to mathematics education, or education generally, to women, a project that would continue on for decades.
Mm-hmm, that's right, yes. Before she came to Cincinnati, she'd founded a school in Hartford for women. And then when she came to Cincinnati, she founded a school there. The social context there in Cincinnati was kind of tricky because Cincinnati was in Ohio, where slavery was not legal, but right across the Ohio River was Kentucky, where slavery was legal. And she felt that she felt compelled to speak out on the slavery question. She tried to find a sort of middle way between the radical abolitionists and the slavery apologists. And I guess you would say basically she got everybody mad at her. And this did not help her in her educational efforts in Cincinnati. Eventually, she left under somewhat unhappy circumstances, I guess I would have to say.
So another pioneer in expanding access to education was Kelly Miller, who himself was, as I recall, the first American Black mathematics graduate student.
Yes, as far as I know, that is correct. Of course, there were not very, when he became a graduate student, graduate study was of any kind for anyone of any race was a rare thing. Harvard and Yale did not have graduate study for quite a while. Yale was a little bit more in advance than Harvard, but the school that really pioneered true graduate study in the way we think of it today was Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, which was founded and opened its doors in 1876. As a graduate student, I was studying at Johns Hopkins in the 1990s and would naturally learn quite a bit about the institution. And the folks there at Hopkins were rightly proud of their own history. And so I learned about some of the things happening at Hopkins. And one of the things I learned there in the 1990s was about this interesting gentleman, Kelly Miller, who had been an early graduate student in the 1880s, graduate student in mathematics, and I think he took some astronomy courses as well. And his father was born in the Carolinas in North Carolina. His father was a free black man, rather a rarity at the time. His mother was born enslaved. But Kelly Miller was born in 1863, I think it was. And so he was, the Emancipation Proclamation had been already promulgated. So he was officially no longer enslaved, although in 1863 there wasn't anybody around to enforce this. But so he grew up in rather impoverished circumstances, but a northern missionary that came down there to educate the newly freed peoples there in the Carolinas saw in Kelly Miller a talented mathematics student. This missionary really didn't have much mathematics background himself, but he, I guess, had enough that he was able to recognize some real talent. And he guided Miller to get a bachelor's degree at Howard University in Washington, D.C., which was a university which was mainly founded with the intention of educating the newly freed folks, both men and women, by the way, at Howard initially.
Right. In some sense, both a co-ed and an integrated university.
That's right. Yes, right from the beginning. Yes, as I might mention shortly, Johns Hopkins was almost strictly male, and I have a chapter about someone who managed to sneak by those regulations a little bit. But anyway, Kelly Miller then graduated from Howard, and then his talents had impressed an individual that he'd gotten to know in the Washington, D.C. technical community, Simon Newcomb, who was at that time the chairman of the department at Hopkins. And he encouraged Miller to apply and got him into the university as a graduate student. Unfortunately, Miller was not able to complete a degree there because they raised the tuition owing to some financial difficulties that Hopkins was having at the time in the 1880s. And so Miller left without a degree, but he had a good solid background and was able to become a professor himself, a professor of mathematics at his alma mater of Howard University, where he then taught mathematics for a couple decades. And according to his autobiography, which is unpublished, and I read in the archives there at Howard, Miller wrote a geometry textbook, which he was unable to find a publisher for. And unhappily, I have been able to find no evidence that the manuscript still exists.
Right. One of the sadder paragraphs I remember reading.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So during this time as a professor at Howard, Miller got increasingly involved in the discussion over blacks and social power. And the name of this chapter is, I think, an especially apt one, Straddler, which refers in part to his wavering between the perspective of Booker T. Washington, this ideology of pulling the black community, pulling itself up by its bootstraps in search of economic independence, versus that of W.E.B. Du Bois, which was that blacks, or at least this talented 10th, should aspire to greater social power through elite education.
Right. Yeah. And Kelly Miller tried to straddle this. You know, sometimes he would lean one way, and sometimes he'd lean another way. And trying to find a sort of middle path there, yes.
Now, you mentioned the quote that opens this chapter refers to another way in which Miller straddles.
Yes. So I was happy with the title of this chapter, this Straddler, because it did have sort of multiple meanings. The quote that opens the chapter is from Kelly Miller, and it reads, "The Negro should plant one foot on the Ten Commandments and the other on the binomial theorem. He can then stand steadfast and immovable, however the rain of racial wrath may fall or the angry winds of prejudice may blow and beat upon him." So he's standing on these two, you know, straddling religion and mathematics here.
Mm-hmm. And am I right to take away from that chapter that he also was a bit of a straddler when it came to devoting himself to research mathematics versus to researching mathematics pedagogy.
Yes, that's right. He had some issues sometimes with, you know, he'd been trained at, you know, at what was then the highest level of available in mathematics in this country at Johns Hopkins. That was really the apex of what could be learned about mathematics in an institution at this time in the United States. So he was, you know, he was raring to go to you know, really do some high level mathematics. And then when he got out and was teaching students, they weren't so enthused as he had been. And it, you know, he had to sort of lower his sights. And so he had to, and he struggled with this. It's pretty clear from reading his autobiography that he got a little bit disappointed, disillusioned with some of his educational ventures that he wished he could teach students that were more attuned to real, you know, what he considered real mathematics. But I think that may have led in turn to partly to his turn towards sociology, where he felt maybe that he was able to do more immediate good than he was had been able to do in mathematics education.
And so the problem of making mathematics attractive to a learning audience takes a different form in the life of E.T. Bell.
Yes. He's a very interesting figure who has deep personal connections to me, because my father, sometime, I would imagine before I was born, bought a copy of Bell's most famous book, which is called Men of Mathematics. It was a book written in 1937 or published in 1937, and it consists of a number of short biographies of famous mathematicians, the cream of the crop of Western European mathematics.
It's right.
Definitely has some, you know, there's a narrowness to it, but it was a very well received book by both mathematicians and lay people, and it's written in a very readable and entertaining style that has long attracted and continues to attract people. I picked it up around the house probably before I was even 13 years old, I would imagine. And started to browse in it, and eventually, you know, read the whole thing, and I found it absolutely delightful and fun, and it helped inspire me to want to be a mathematician. And I, from reading about others' reactions to this, I'm not far from the only one who was inspired by E.T. Bell in this way. Now, later on, when I became a historian, I began to learn about how Bell had embellished facts, and was, you know, some of his statements are kind of wild and woolly, and I became to have very much more ambivalent view of him, but nevertheless he's still someone who I have to say, in some ways, influenced the present book, because, you know, he did have a series of chapters somewhat in the same way that I have a series of short biographies, and so there's no doubt that he influenced the book.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about your ambivalence towards his mode of communication, because this is something that also really struck me when I read this chapter. I grew up in a household very science oriented. I was encouraged to play with little science kits. I was introduced to Carl Sagan and later Neil deGrasse Tyson, and like your learning more about E.T. Bell, I eventually came to realize through other historians' work that these popularizers of science often embellished or misrepresented the histories of the disciplines they were communicating. And I wonder if, to you, Bell seems to fit that mold.
Yes, he does. He definitely does. Some of what he's saying is he's trying to be entertaining, clearly, and often he succeeds, but he is misrepresenting things to a somewhat unfortunate degree. He was, in terms of the chapter that I wrote about him, he's very interesting to write about because he had such a varied career. He had essentially three different careers within mathematics that are, well, I guess one of them is not really mathematics per se, but he was a research mathematician in number theory. His work, it's a little hard. I'm not qualified to judge his work in number theory. I don't think he's considered, you know, one of the giants of the field, but he apparently still has, there's some who find some of his work of interest. And he was quite prolific. I know that. And then he was also quite prolific as a writer of science fiction. I've read some of it. It's interesting, but it doesn't, to me, it doesn't read nearly as entertainingly as his popular mathematics books. So his first career was as a research mathematician. His second career was as a science fiction writer, and his third and most important career, I believe, was as a popularizer of mathematics and science.
It occurs to me that Bell's careers are representative or indicative, maybe, of the transition that mathematics had successfully made by this point to professionalization, to becoming a learned profession. Because as I read it, it's difficult to have specialties within a discipline that doesn't have a vibrant professional community. And it doesn't really make sense to popularize a discipline that hasn't already become somewhat distanced from the public by its professionalization.
Yes, I think that's very true. That's a very good way to put it. And Bell, the fact that Bell was able to carry on these three different writing careers is really pretty remarkable, but I don't know of anybody else who's really managed to do that. It's at a time when it's becoming harder and harder. I think he was doing this at a time when it was becoming harder and harder to be a real research mathematician and to do anything else in addition to that. That's pretty remarkable.
Well, some other writers who had difficulty maintaining the commercial viability of their mathematics popularization were Lillian Lieber and Hugh Lieber.
Yes. And as I recall, Corey, you mentioned, I think, that you had not heard of them before you read my book.
I had not,
correct?
And I very quickly added several of their books to my queue.
I came to them relatively late myself. I mentioned that Men in Mathematics was a book my father had bought long ago, and it was literally lying around the house there, but he did not have any of the Lieber books. I vaguely recall him mentioning their most famous book, which is The Education of T.C. Mitz. But I think their kind of whimsical humor did not appeal to my father particularly, and so he didn't buy any of their books. They were writing roughly contemporaneously with Bell, but with a very different style. Lillian Lieber had actually come to this country as an immigrant from what is now Ukraine. She came from a Jewish family that immigrated in the 1880s, and she was a very young child at the time. And then she grew up in New York City and eventually went to Barnard and Columbia, and then went to Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts, and got a PhD in chemistry, actually. Although she turned more and more towards mathematics after that. She taught at a number of different schools in New York and New England before finally landing at Long Island University. Before she went to the Long Island University, she had done some further graduate work in mathematics at Columbia, where she met Hugh Lieber, her future husband, and they both ended up as professors at Long Island University. But initially, I think they were both in mathematics, but Hugh then became more and more interested in art and became the chairman of the art department, and Lillian became the chairman of the mathematics department. And they began in the 1930s to write a series of popular books about mathematics in a very unique style. They were illustrated by Hugh in a very rather fantastic sort of whimsical way. And Lillian wrote all the words, and the text was all written in a way. All the lines were left justified, and there's a lot of white space, and so it looks on the page like it's poetry or verse. She always insisted that this was not her intention. She just thought that this way of presenting text made for greater readability, and there's something to that. I'll be interested about your reaction, Corey, when you actually, sit down and try to read these things. They read somehow differently than an ordinary book.
I will let you know.
And they wrote a number of these books. They started off writing about rather technical subjects, Galois theory and non-Euclidean geometry, and they wrote a rather detailed book about special and general relativity with lots of, details about tensor calculus with subscripts and superscripts, and far beyond the technical details that Bell tries to put into any of his popular books. Then their most famous book, which came out in the 1940s, was this book called The Education of T.C. Mitz. It's an acronym, stands for The Celebrated Man in the Street. And it has some whimsical parts to it, but also includes some rather technical stuff. There's some stuff about finite geometries, which is you don't find very much anywhere in a popular book. So it's quite a unique approach to getting people interested in mathematics. It fell out of favor after her death, or even before her death. I guess Hugh died first in the 1960s, and then these books kind of went out of print in the 1960s. They've had a little bit of resurgence in the 2000s. So there's a small publisher, Paul Dry Books in Philadelphia, who has been reprinting some of them with some success.
Now, reviewing the last three subjects the last four subjects we've discussed, Kelly Miller, E.T. Bell, and the Liebers, something that I can't help but notice is that they incorporate mathematics progressively more into the humanities or intersect it with the humanities, the development of sociology, the study of the history of mathematics, and the expression or the communication of mathematics through poetry or verse or prose and art. And I wonder what you think of this period, this century-long period, as the emergence of the mathematical humanities.
Yeah, I guess it's probably connected with what you were mentioning earlier, this professionalization. Mathematics is, at one level, it's becoming very much more esoteric and hard for people to appreciate what the researchers are doing. And so there is some sort of, there are pressures. There are pressures to try to do something to connect it with what people might have some more knowledge of or affinity for. And I think that does contribute to these various attempts in different ways, but all have this common commonality of trying to connect mathematics with some other activity, some other human endeavor that might be more that ordinary educated people might be more attuned to.
And so, veering back into mathematics research and pedagogy, jumping ahead to Isaac Virchow.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Who was involved somewhat in the development or the popularization of the so-called new math.
Yes.
And seemed to have left a lasting influence on at least the University of Chicago community.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, he was one who I had interviewed in the year 2000. I conducted an interview with him before he died. And he came from a very interesting background. He was a Holocaust survivor. He experienced some truly dreadful experiences in the World War II era over in Poland, where he grew up. Before the war, he had been a student of one of the great mathematicians of the 20th century, Antoni Zygmunt, great figure in trigonometric series and related mathematics. And Zygmunt had made his way over to this country early on in World War II, fortunately escaped much of what Virchow had to go through. And Zygmunt later on invited Virchow to, after the war, Virchow was living in France, and Zygmunt invited Virchow to come over to the United States at the University of Chicago, where Zygmunt was establishing a major research school in Fourier analysis. And Virchow came over, wrote a dissertation on something related to Fourier analysis, but then decided that what he could most make a contribution to mathematics by in the area of mathematics education. He could bring to bear his knowledge of what was going on in educational fields, educational thought in Eastern Europe, especially the Soviet Union. He thought that the United States had a lot to learn from what the Soviets were doing, and he proceeded to create a translation project starting in the 1960s that would translate a number of important works written by the Soviets about math education and distribute these to educators in the United States. He, for example, he discovered that the Soviets had become very interested in some Dutch thinkers who were the Van Hielas, who were writing about psychology of mathematics and coming up with some interesting ideas that the Soviets were applying over there, and Virchow was able to bring the Van Hiela ideas to this country, and where they have been influential.
Now, I've been to several dinners with colleagues at the homes of my professors during my graduate education and since, but never have they had the feeling, as you describe it, of the salons that Virchow would host. So
yes, Virchow and his wife were there at the University of Chicago. You know, Chicago is a very high-powered research university, and Mr. and Mrs. Virchow became concerned when their daughter was taking classes at the University of Chicago that she wasn't really having much contact with these great research people in mathematics and in other fields, and they determined that they would do something about this, and they became housemasters of a undergraduate residence there at the University of Chicago, and then they established a lecture program basically. Where they would invite someone to give a little talk, and then they would have everybody over to their apartment for snacks and drinks, and you know that you get to talk with Milton Friedman or Saul Bellow or whoever happened to be the speaker, and it was really quite a remarkable intellectual feast, as I understand it.
So another mathematician who did a significant amount of translating work was Joe Diaz.
Yes, yes. Now he's one who I have deep roots, deep connections, personal connections with. I'm pretty sure that he went to my parents' wedding, I think, in 1949. My father took a graduate course in partial differential equations from him at Brown University in the 1940s. And so I knew Joe from as long as I can remember. He was a research mathematician. I make a point of referring to him as someone who was not, I wouldn't call him a great mathematician, but he was a very productive and very productive mathematician who took his role seriously in the mathematics community. And one of the things that he did was his advisor was another very important mathematician, Lippmann Behrs, who Joe was Lippmann Behrs' first PhD student at Brown University. Behrs was not at Brown very long, but Joe Diaz was his student there. And from Behrs, Diaz learned of the importance of the large amount of important mathematical research being published in Russian. And Behrs was fluent in Russian, and he encouraged Joe to become expert in Russian so that Joe was able to translate a number of papers from Russian into English. So it was an important service, which Joe was very big on serving the mathematics community with serving on committees and reviewing submissions to journals and giving talks at meetings and so on. And that's a service that, you know, some mathematicians kind of resent it, I think, especially, well, I shouldn't cast aspersions on people, but... there are those who feel, you know, anything taking away from their own personal research is just wasted time. But Joe did not feel that way, and he really tried to serve the community in any way he could.
You also portray him in my reading as someone very enthusiastic about the fading of barriers. So he never made. He never strongly identified as a Puerto Rican or as a Hispanic American.
Right. Yes, that's true. Yeah, and you know, I certainly don't claim that he is representative of all Hispanic Americans in this regard. But that was the way he felt that you know he was just trying to be a good citizen of mathematics mainly. He didn't feel that he was representing the Puerto Rican community or the Hispanic community at large.
But in addition, a lot of his work seemed to be focused not on the unlocking of brand new results, but on the improvement of our understanding of known results.
Exactly. Yes, he wrote a number of papers, for example, as I mentioned in the book, about, you know, a very basic topic, the mean value theorem, and, you know, just trying to tweak things and give new insights into known results in such a way that he would, you know, advance the field in a small but important way. And as I mentioned, some mathematicians don't believe that this is worthy of their attention. There's some mathematicians who feel, you know, only the great theorems are worth proving, and anything else is just sort of not worth it.
And so another element that comes through in Joe Diaz's story, which we haven't seen as much as we might have in the chapters we've talked about, is his work towards military applications of mathematics.
Yes, yes. That's, I guess I have some, I would say I have personal connections with this too. My father, when he was first out of graduate school, was employed as a civilian with the United States Navy at the Naval Ordnance Laboratory in White Oak, Maryland, and Joe Diaz was a consultant there too. So I was aware from early on that one of the things you could do with mathematics, one of the things that it was used for, was in fact in military applications. That was something I was very much aware of. And then later on, I would have my own career in that field as well. Now I wasn't aware, I guess, until much later, about how long this, how historically long this relationship between mathematics and military applications had been. As I mentioned in the chapter about West Point and Sylvanus Thayer, this goes back quite a ways, but I wasn't really aware of that until much later.
Yeah, actually, it was very rewarding to me as a reader to be able to recognize how far back into American history we can trace these trends of not only academic mathematics, but military mathematics and the research into pedagogy and expansion of access to math education. Another long-term trajectory that you comment on is the material with which Joe Diaz did most of his work, which was differential equations. I wonder if you could elaborate on that comment a bit.
Yeah, that has some personal resonance for me too. One of my favorite memories is of I've mentioned my grandfather, R. Bruce Lindsay, who's mentioned very briefly in the book because he was a student of one of my chapter subjects, E.B. Wilson. And my grandfather was a PhD physicist who felt in many ways that his mathematics background was inadequate. And he expressed this to me very vividly one time when I was probably about 13 or 14 years old. And he said to me that my greatest problem in life is that I never really understood the solution to partial differential equations. And I was kind of amused at this, and actually for a while sort of inspired. I kind of thought to myself, well, by golly, when I grow up, I'm going to learn how to solve partial differential equations. But as it turned out, I never really got to be very interested in partial differential equations. I'm not sure what that says about me, but that's the case. But I was certainly very well aware from this comment by my grandfather that they were a major field within mathematics, a major field where the applications of mathematics were very prominent, especially in physics. And so I knew that it was a big deal. Partial differential equations generally were a very big deal in mathematics, and they do keep popping up in a number of my chapters. The people that I'm writing about have some connection with differential equations in some way. So I was kind of amused to find that in some ways. And then I happened to read a comment by the British American mathematical physicist Stephen Wolfram in his huge volume, A New Kind of Science. I forget, it was published a few years back, I forget the year, but he does make some comment. Let's see, let me I should just read it. Where he says, Wolfram says he believes that the current predominance of partial differential equations is in many respects a historical accident. So what this means is that in the future, when the ideas and methods of this book have successfully been absorbed, the field of mathematics as it exists today will come to be seen as a small and surprisingly uncharacteristic sample of what is actually possible. And what Wolfram seems to be saying is that, you know, we've existed, mathematics has existed for centuries here, and in the last several centuries, partial differential equations have been a very prominent part. But if we follow Wolfram's advice, they will sort of disappear, and we'll do everything with computer simulations, and we won't actually worry so much about the things we worried about with differential equations for these last few centuries. I'm a little bit unclear about how this will really work in practice, but it's an interesting idea.
It strikes me as a very natural and understandable extrapolation from the transition to or from analytic to numerical methods, which you cover a couple of times in the book. For instance, in your discussion of Grace Mary Hopper's work,
That's right. Yeah, she had started out in rather theoretical mathematics, but ended up becoming much more attuned to numerical methods. And this certainly helped her when she got into the computer field.
And so, to recap several of the threads within the development of mathematics in America, in the United States, your book contains many discussions of military institutions and military applications, of developments in mathematics education, and of the growth in the culture and in the influence of the academy. But one through line you mention you don't give much play is the role of mathematics in industry. So I wonder if you could say a word about that.
That certainly is a deficiency, I would say, in my book. The only one who really might fit that is Grace Hopper. Maybe you might include Herman Hollerith to some degree. I'm certainly aware that that there's a lot of mathematics that has been gone on in industry. I mentioned, for example, the famous Bell Labs that was prominent back in the 20th century, with employing many mathematicians. During my oral history interview period, I did interview one mathematician, Henry Pollack, who was employed at Bell Labs. I really didn't probe his industry work so much, because I was mainly interested in him because of his interest in math education, which he conducted sort of side by side with his industry work. I wouldn't have been able to say write a chapter about him which would have intelligently discussed his industry work. But I'm aware that people like him have existed, there's. Perhaps that's something that I might consider as a follow-on to learn more about just exactly how mathematicians in industry have operated, how they've interacted with the academy. That's certainly something that could be done.
Is that to say that there might be a new book project on the way?
Well, yeah, I feel like I ought to be doing something. This was a great deal of fun to write this book. And I would be delighted to find another project which would interest me as much. And that's perhaps a topic that might work out. Another another topic that I was actually working on before my editor there at Hopkins, Vince Burke, proposed this book that became Republic of Numbers. What I was working on before then was thinking about how to put together a book about the so-called new math education reforms of the 1950s and 60s. Now, since that time, a friend of mine, Chris Phillips, has written a book about that subject, a very nice book, which covers some of the things I might have said, but I still have some contributions that would be distinct from what Chris has to offer. So I think I have something more to say about the new math, and I'm trying to decide whether that might be something that I might contribute to. That's a subject that has personal resonance for me as well, because I really grew up during that period, and I tend to feel a little bit more positive about it than some commentators do. I felt I got a good deal out of the attempt to bring a little bit more abstraction into the curriculum at that time.
So that would be interesting to know about if you do end up penning a new book on the topic. Thank you. So one question I'd like to ask before closing is, with respect to the present book, would you recommend for listeners who are eager to pick it up another piece of scholarship or media that makes a good companion to it?
Well, as a matter of fact, there's a book that's coming out by the late David Zittirelli, and I'm a little bit unclear when it's coming out. It's being published by the MAA, but as you may know, the MAA now publishes its books under the auspices of the AMS. But anyway, David's book, he died earlier this year, a good friend of mine. And his book is titled, A History of Mathematics in the United States and Canada. And there's a cover of the book that I've seen somewhere that suggests that he talks about some of the same people that I talk about. I think the cover has pictures of Kelly Miller and Christine Ladd Franklin. I'm sure that David will cover things in a different way than I have. And he's more concerned, much more focused on research mathematics than I have been. I try to give a sort of equal play to mathematics education. But David's book should be an interesting companion to mine.
And your book, to reiterate, is Republic of Numbers, Unexpected Stories of Mathematical Americans Through History. Dave, thanks very much for joining me on New Books in Mathematics.
Thank you, Corey. I enjoyed it very much.
Sorry, can we take another try and record that outro?
Okay, sure.
And your book is Republic of Numbers, Unexpected Stories of Mathematical Americans Through History. David Lindsay Roberts, thanks so much for joining me on New Books in Mathematics.
Thank you, Corey. I enjoyed it very much.